Hello to everyone from around the world, and welcome to today's webinar, Acerti's Balancing Act, Co-Optimizing TX and RX Equalization Settings to Maximize Margin, brought to you by SciSoft and broadcast by UBM. I'm Chris Keach, and I'll be your moderator today. We have just a few brief announcements before we begin. First, this webcast contains audience polling. The polling questions will appear in the slide presentation window. Please complete the poll when they appear, and then click the Submit Answer button located on the polling slide window. Thank you in advance for your participation. You can also participate in our Q&A session by asking questions at any time during this webinar. Just type your question into the Q&A text area located to the right of the presentation window, and then click the Submit button. Please note that we'll try to get to as many questions as we can with the time that we have left at the end of the webinar, but if we do not get to your question today, someone will get back to you via email. And at this time, we recommend that you disable your computer's pop-up blockers. This will allow the slides to advance automatically throughout the event. You may also download a copy of the slides by clicking on the Additional Resources button located below the presentation window. And if you're experiencing any technical problems, please visit our webinar help guide by clicking on the help link below the presentation window. In addition, you can contact our technical support helpline, which is also located in the webinar help guide. And now, on to the presentation. Acerti's Balancing Act, Co-Optimizing TX and RX Equalization Settings to Maximize Margin. Today's speakers are Todd Westerhoff, Vice President, Semiconductor Relations, SciSoft. And joining him today is Donald Tellian, Signal Integrity Consultant, Owner, SciGuys. Welcome, Todd. I'll now hand things over to you to get us started. Todd?
Good morning. Thank you, Chris, and thank you, everybody, for being with us today. We want to take a closer look at how you can maximize transmit and receive settings to maximize margin. Actually, let me do it this way. So if we could, I'd like to start off with just getting a little sense of who you are and what you do, and more importantly, how you analyze serial links today. So if you could take a look at your screen, there's a poll here. We're asking you to just pick all of the things that apply to you in particular, because we'd like to get a sense of sort of your background and how we might better present this material. So if you guys could go ahead and take a look at that and answer this question, we can go ahead and get into the webinar itself. And I see some answers coming in. That's awesome. And I'll give it about another 15, 20 seconds here just to stabilize, because it looks like there are a few people still coming in. Okay, last call coming up. Please, if you haven't voted, go ahead and do so. And then we'll take a look at how this distributed out. And let's take a look. So, looks like under 10% of you have somebody else do it, which is great. 70% of you measure channels in the lab. And about 50% of the rest look for mass compliance. About half of you use AMI simulations, which is awesome. And about half of you are already familiar with some of the methods we're going to talk today. And then about a third of you use in-house tools and processes. So thank you very much. So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about co-optimization, specifically balancing transmit receiver settings and finding the optimum balance. We're going to look at some methods that you can use to go do that. And then we're going to take a look at how those methods work when applied to some real-world channels. Take a look at how you can do that for yourself using SciSoft tools, and then summarize. So co-optimization, as we use the term, means carefully setting the transmit and receiver settings of Acerti's in concert to maximize link margin. The reasons why you want to do this are fairly obvious. The number of serial links in our designs has exploded in recent years, and the data rates are skyrocketing, so the margins are lower than they ever were before, and we've known for some time now that you can't just isolate a transmitter in isolation, for example, and expect the receiver to pick up the load. The way that you optimize the transmitter has a big impact on what the receiver is able to ultimately do. As we shift to things like PAM4, our one eye is turning into three, so that margin is getting divided by three. And even though we'd like to believe often that we can rely on hardware to auto-negotiate and link train on its own, that doesn't work a lot of the time, and so we're left having to set these things for ourselves. One of the recurring themes that we're seeing is that if we look at serial channels, they tend to be divided into two broad categories. We have our longer channels, which are dominated by loss, which is sort of the classic problem that equalization has been designed to combat. And then we're seeing a lot of channels that are shorter, particularly as we bring channels onto the same board and not crossing backplanes anymore. And inter-symbol interference is actually becoming a big problem. Everybody talks about the difficulty in equalizing short channels. And we've seen that presents unique equalization challenges of its own. In all cases, when we have hardware in the lab and something's not performing right, if we can figure out a way to rebalance the transmitter and receiver and get more margin out of a failing link, that's a huge win, because I can take something that wasn't working and make it work without a hardware spin. So our goal is actually pretty simple. You know, we want to look at the receiver, we want to look at the eye and in the receiver at the sampling latch, and we want to open the eye and maximize it. But one of the important points that we want to make is that you need to optimize the eye at the point in the eye where the recovered clock is going to sample it. And even though we'd like to believe that the recovered clock automatically just always samples that eye at its biggest point, the fact is it doesn't necessarily do that. And so whenever we're looking at analysis of eyes, we need two things. Number one, how high can we get that eye opening? And secondly, where is the recovered clock actually going to sample it? Because that's the point that we care about. One of the things that's been around for a while now is the ability to take a pulse response and turn it into an eye diagram. In fact, if you look at this slide, this has been reported as far back as 2004. And so today, when we're using techniques like IBIS AMI models and we're talking about things like statistical analysis, we're using these techniques of recursive convolution to take a pulse response and turn it into an eye diagram. In fact, you can see there's an equalized pulse response up there on the top left, and there's the eye diagram that corresponds to it down there in the middle. And you can see that thin black line in the middle of it, that's the clock time as predicted by the simulator for where that eye will be sampled. And so since we can take this pulse response and derive an eye, now what we can do is actually go take a closer look at a pulse response itself, figure out what characteristics it has, how equalization might operate on it to make it better, and start evaluating some of these trade-offs of how we want to approach the equalization problem. And so if I take a look at a pulse response for a serial channel, and at the moment I'm going to start with an unequalized pulse response. You can think of it as the channel response. I noticed that in almost all of them I look at, there are four salient characteristics that are common. Number one, the rise time is fairly short. It's typically less than a bit time. Sometimes it'll be maybe two, but that's pretty unusual. The peak voltage of the pulse response is usually well below the rail-to-rail step response. If I put a step response into the system and let it settle, the peak voltage I see in the pulse response is obviously usually well short of that. The tail, the time it takes that thing to get back down to 0 volts, is many bit times long, typically 10 to 20, depending again on your data rate and the characteristics of your individual channel. And then there's ringing due to discontinuity, energy that's banging back and forth in the channel. And all of these things are characteristic to a greater or lesser degree of almost any pulse response that I look at. Now, make one other point here, and that is that to get the ringing right, you absolutely need to accurately model the transmitter's output impedance and the receiver's input impedance. If you're not modeling the TX-RX analog components right, you're not going to get to the point where you can predict ringing correctly. Now, in order to look at the effect of equalization, we find it useful to normalize the pulse response. And so we have a particular method that we like to use to plot it that allows us to understand how much energy we're losing to inter-symbol interference. And we call this an ISI pulse response, or you could think of it as a normalized pulse response. And what we're doing here is we're taking the pulse and we're using an algorithm called the hula hoop algorithm that was defined in the DesignCon paper that we just presented to figure out where the sampling clock is actually going to be reading that single bit response. And then we take our pulse response and center that so that becomes time zero. Then what we do is we take the x-axis and we mark it in unit intervals. So depending on the data rate, we mark it off in UI. And what this allows us to do is read the inter-symbol interference energy at unit intervals before and after the sampling time. And so in this particular diagram, that green line is the voltage at the sampling time for this pulse, which happens to be about 300 and some odd millivolts. All right. And then all of those blue lines represent the inner symbol interference energy before and after that sampling time. There's the one on the left, that's your precursor ISI, and then you've got all the ones on the right, which are your postcursor ISI. And in any individual pulse response, what happens is it's the maximum height, the green line, minus the sum of all the blues is telling me basically what I have available to open my eye with. So if I had no inner symbol interference energy at all, this thing would be a little over 300 millivolts high. The fact is that if I take all of those ISI energies and add them together, it's more than my eye opening. So this eye is not only closed, it's actually closed beyond the midpoint. And once I start to look at a pulse response this way, now I can evaluate any particular equalization scheme and what it's doing for me, and what, in some cases, what it's doing for me, in some cases, what it's costing me. And so let's take a look at that pulse response, both unequalized and optimally equalized. And so this is the same case that we just looked at. You see the red line there, or the red waveform, is the unequalized pulse response. The blue line is the same pulse response with an optimal combination of transmit and receive equalization settings. All right, now we've put vertical black markers at each of the bit times that the transmit and receive equalization can affect. So in this particular case, we've got one precursor tap in the transmitter, we've got two postcursor taps, we've got a four-tap DFE, we also have a CTLE present in the system. And what we've done is we've marked the 5-bit times that we can touch with our taps, whether it be in the transmitter or the receiver. If you look at the blue waveform, you can see at those unit interval boundaries, the combination of the transmitter tap and the DFE is taking that energy right through 0 volts, just at the point where you're trying to sample that signal, which is the ideal thing to be doing with ISI. Now, interestingly, you can see the DFE there in the post cursor. You've got all kinds of stuff going on as that thing is correcting it, but at the point in time where we're actually sampling that, that waveform is going through 0 volts, and that's going to be the contribution to eye closure due to ISI. Now, you see a couple of other really interesting things here. If you look at that blue waveform, you see that we've minimized the ISI, but we've also paid a big price in amplitude to do it. You can see that amplitude has been reduced substantially. And even more interestingly, if you look at time at cursor minus 2, you can see there's some residual ISI that's left, which turns out to be a particularly interesting case. If we look up at the top left, there's the eye diagram for the unequalized eye, and as we said, it's literally closed beyond zero. And then if we look at the top right, there's the eye diagram for the equalized eye, showing us essentially the same thing. The peak-to-peak amplitude of the signal has been closed down, but the eye has actually been opened up. And you can see pretty clearly now how those, I'd call them sawtooth artifacts, for lack of a better term, in the equalized pulse response, are correlating to the characteristic ridges that we see in a DFE equalized eye. So by the way, we also have some ISI in this plot that can't be removed. There's nothing that we can do about that because it's outside the range of our DFE taps. But displaying the particular diagram or displaying the pulse this way allows me very quickly to get a sense of what can I do something about, what can I not do anything about, and how well is any particular equalization solution performing. So armed with that knowledge, now I can step back and take a look at, well, how does different type of equalization work? What does it actually do? And I could look at like my pre and post cursor taps in my transmitter. I can look at the behavior of my peaking filter and my DFE. And what we did here is we took that pulse response and we took one of these individual pieces of equalization and swept it so that we could see what it does to the signal. So not surprisingly, you look at the precursor in the top left, you can see it lets me deal with precursor energy because that's the only part in the whole system that understands what the next bit will be when the previous bit is being transmitted. None of that knowledge exists in the receiver. We can see in the top right, the transmit postcursor does a great job of helping me manage that tail energy and bring that down to zero fairly quickly, but it costs me amplitude. If we look in the bottom left, we look at the peaking filter there. And I'll make the point that peaking filters are going to be very implementation dependent. We can see how this particular peaking filter affects my pulse response and whether or not I want to use it to try to manage my post-cursor energy. In fact, whether it might be a better solution than my transmitter. And the DFE in the bottom right, I always find those interesting because it illustrates very clearly the fact that the DFE has a very localized effect. All of these other things have multi-bit effects, but the DFE is only affecting the one bit where it takes has its setting, and beyond that, it has no effect on the pulse response at all. And so now when I look at any particular pulse response, now I can start thinking about, okay, how bad is this problem for this particular channel, and what do I want to do about it? So if I'm looking at my precursor, I'm interested in how many taps of precursor do I have, how bad is it, am I going to use my transmit precursor, which is probably the most effective, or will my CTLE maybe get some of it for me? I know that my DFE isn't going to help me at all. If I look at my tails, I know that my transmit precursor is going to be most effective, but it's going to cost me energy. So I think about how do I want to play that balance. And most typically with ringing, I'm trying to think about, is my DFE going to get to it? As an example, in a 25 gigabit system, my unit interval is 40 picoseconds. So if I have 10 DFE taps, I can only adjust things out to 400 picoseconds. And 400 picoseconds in length is really not much. It's like less than 3 inches away from the receiver is the only thing that I'm going to be able to equalize out. And that's if I'm talking about energy coming in without looking at the reflection, which cuts that distance in half. So typically what happens is in long channels, most of my reflective energy gets attenuated out, and I'm worried about my precursor and my tail. In short channels, ringing is usually my challenge, but it's often out of the range of my DFE taps, which is one of the reasons why we talk about short channels being hard to equalize. So then what we did is we took that same channel and we equalized it three different ways. And we did it by using the transmitter only, we used the receiver only, and then we balanced the transmitter and the receiver. And it just happens that this channel is low loss enough that I can find a solution with one or the other equalization only. And so interestingly enough, if you look in the top left, you can see that using the transmitter by itself actually gave me a better answer than using the receiver by itself. That happens because this channel is dominated by loss. And so my biggest part of my problem is my precursor and postcursor energy, and the transmitter will do a good job of managing that. The receiver can do it with the CTLE, but by the time it brings that pulse width down, it's lost too much amplitude to make up for it. But most interestingly, if I look on the top right, here's where I can get if I find the right balance of my transmitter and receiver settings. And so what I'm always doing is I'm looking at this and making the trade-off. Every time I use my transmitter, I'm paying for it with amplitude. So I want to use it as little as possible. My CTLE can really help me, but only if it's got gain at Nyquist or particular characteristics that I need. And my DFE is a great solution as long as my taps can get to it. So before we go to the next session of our presentation here, I'd like to ask you guys this question. Are you using any of these methods by looking at pulse responses and other forms of equalization to manage your CERTES links today? If you could take a look at that. And again, pick as many of those that apply. Just get a sense of where you guys are at in terms of how you're doing equalization settings today. And I'll give it about another 20 seconds if you could just finish up. Okay, let's take a look at the results. I just saw it change again. I'll give another 10 seconds. Last call. Okay, looks like we're stabilizing, so let's take a look at that. So again, pretty even distribution here. About 53% of you report trading off eye height and eye width, which is a great thing. About a 15% of you aren't using these methods, but very interesting results. So thank you. That helps us a great deal. So at this point, what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask Donald Tellian to present some examples of what has happened when he's used these techniques to equalize real-world channels. So, Donald, I'm going to advance the slide and turn it over to you.
Okay, Todd, thank you very much. I hope everyone is understanding that there's a number of things at play here when we talk about this balancing act and trading TX and RX, and I think Todd did an excellent job of going through the kinds of trade-offs that we would think about if we were looking at a pulse response, or perhaps how we could train a computer to look at a pulse response. So from here, I'm going to talk about that in a little more detail and also show you some of the automation and what it looks like from the outside. I've been privileged to work with this technology now for about a dozen years and seen it come through different generations. This is now the third generation of this technology. And so I'm going to approach this by first telling you about an industry case study that Todd already mentioned briefly, and then we're going to look at the technology on the different types of channels shown there. So you heard Todd say that there was a industry paper presented last month at DesignCon, and this paper, you know, if you find what Todd was explaining very interesting, or if it went by kind of fast, I would refer you to what's pretty well documented in this paper. It goes through not only a practical application where we were first kind of stressing the technology and trying it out in the real world, but also gives you the detail you might be looking for on the hula hoop algorithm, or more detail on what is going on in the balancing act and trading between TX and RX. So that paper is available both at the SciSoft and the SciGuides websites. I refer you to that. We were in a bit of a pickle with the system at hand there, and you can see, I'll just briefly mention the eye height width plots there described in the paper, where a number of channels, kind of you see in black and gold there, they were not hitting our performance targets. They were below the horizontal line there. And so this was a great opportunity to throw the system to the optimizer and try out some co-optimization. And I was very glad to see that we found better than 60% performance that we were leaving on the table. I wouldn't have thought so because these settings we had worked on for a number of years. But we were confronted with some links that were 25% longer and found some way to remove dozens of components. Retimers in this case. So that's good detail both on co-optimization and this particular system. Today, I'm going to now throw the canvas, make it a lot wider, and look at different types of channels. I think the deeper you get into this, the more fascinating it becomes. And this is an example from the paper that talks about some of the equations presented therein and compares that with what happens if you step back and you co-optimize at the TX and RX level. So the problem is kind of pathological. We just have a very long channel here. We're trying to equalize it. And in blue, you can see the equalized pulse response if we use the zero forcing algorithm. And that's very understandable. You can solve the equations yourself, and it takes, although about an hour per tap to go through that, but if you do that by hand. but it was interesting to give the same problem to the co-optimizer and find out that there was a better eye. And so this is where we're all learning. We know that ISI is bad, but if you're doing the balancing act, you can trade a little bit of ISI for amplitude and come up with a better result, as shown in the eyes there. So that was understandable, but albeit a little slow. So I took the same channel and threw it at what most of us would typically do. We would sweep through the different options and I'm plotting those and doing a couple passes and finding that I can get it to converge on what at least a blind sweep would suggest are the best results. And this took me about an hour to complete that. It did converge, thankfully. If you start turning on RX equalization, the results do not converge as nicely as shown there in those plots. The interesting thing here is that it took about an hour to work through this process. So I was faster than doing my hand calculation, but the co-optimizer ran in less than a second. So this is, I think, important technology because as we're, you know, the system I show in the industry paper, we've got thousands of channels we're equalizing. So if you're working with 1,000 channels and you're spending an hour on each one, the bad news is that that'll take you a half year to do that. So we, you know, this is why new technologies are birthed. So before I go into the scenarios and different types of channels to kind of measure what co-optimization can get me, what I want to make sure you understand is that everything I'm about to show you is available in a project file that you can get from SciSoft, and you'll be able to fly this plane yourself and try it out and you know, maybe my data rate isn't applicable to you, or you don't like the way that I set it up. All that it's all set up with parameters that you can modify. And also I want to state and make clear that from this point forward now, instead of using the term co-optimization, I will be specifically, and Todd as well, referring to the embodiment in the SciSoft QCD platform that is now cleverly titled Optimi. So the first set of channels are just S parameters. I'm just dropping an S4P in between a transmitter and receiver. And I wanted to see what the passive characteristics that I'm testing look like. I have shown in green here 7 industry channels. These are basic backplanes, cables, things you can download from the internet. And then I also went into my bag of channels and pulled out some that I knew were particularly problematic from in terms of ISI, and those are shown in red. And you can see that they break the KR masks and different, certainly the insertion loss deviation shown in black there. But if you just look at the return loss or the insertion loss, you can see that those have a lot of ringing in the frequency domain. And then I have some channels that tend towards being more lossy in blue, and one kind of a channel that I expect to see fail. It has a huge amount of loss, and I'm calling that the failing channel. So again, I said that I dropped that S-parameter channel in between some advanced transmit and receive. I'm running at 10 gigabits per second. I threw in some jitter. And I have, you know, a CTLE in the things that you would expect. So in order to measure what Optimi is doing, I created some baseline preset scenarios that are shown in red and blue there. And the red scenario is, I guess what this is someone knows that equalization is good, and but they're not sure what to do with it. So all the TX taps are just turned up about halfway. Obviously, that's not going to be optimal, but you know, we're in a space where everyone's learning how these things work and how they contrast with each other. In blue, I have the PCI Express preset number 7, and I appended to that a little bit because I have one extra tap than the spec specifies. So I did turn on TX tap 2 just a little bit. And then we'll be comparing those with the Optimi results in green, and the ARCS DFE in all 3 scenarios is always doing the best it can. It's running in auto and trying to recover the signal to the best of its ability. So to see how this worked on the S parameter channels, I've plotted all 20 channels on the x-axis here versus eye height on the y-axis. And so you can see the PCI Express preset is certainly doing better than the red preset. But what's interesting is you see that Optimi is showing some pretty impressive improvements there in green. Now, these improvements, if you look from left to right, you can see that the amount of improvement can change based on the type of channel that you have. So, and I see this fairly consistently. If the channel is more loss dominated, you see that the Optimi is getting a better result, but it's not quite as dramatic as the ISI channels you see at center. And then, of course, we see pretty good results in the industry channels as well. At the bottom, you can see the eyes for channel number 10. And this is the name of the game, right? I had some presets. I thought they might be okay, but the eyes are basically closed. And so by running the optimizer, we find that we can open the eye. And that's, what, of course, what we're after. The next set of channels I want to talk about are drawn on, as you might do in pre-layout. And this is a backplane scenario. I have three cards and a couple connectors and various lengths at play here, as you see on the screen. the superimposed TDR shows that I'm working with some basic manufacturing tolerances, both in my connectors, my vias, and my traces. So I'm running this again at 10 gigabits per second, and I have the same equalization options that I explained previously. And due to the sweeping of the different types of vias and lengths, I wind up with 48 unique channels, and those have the passive characteristics that you see here. So this is a good range. I've got, again, challenging Optimi with ISI constraint and loss-dominated channels. I have about 20 dB range. They're all pretty much above the KR mass shown in black. So let's look at how Optimi did on these channels. This is similar to the plot I showed previously. However, I've now added length shown in black there. And like we saw last time, as the length increases, the channels become increasingly loss dominated. And at short lengths, they're a little more ISI constrained. So again, the results look rather impressive in the ISI space, and part of that is because equalization as we know it today is primarily focused on loss, and I think we'll see that change over the next so many years as we work with floating taps and other things to get ringing out of the network. on the bottom, I have another eye. In this case, this is channel 2, and I didn't mention previously, but I also put the widths on here, and generally, Optimi widths look better than the presets, but the Optimi will go and trade a little width for height, and we find that that gets you to a better bit error rate. Of course, PAM4 is on a lot of our radar, and I think this is a space where we have a much more complex system and, of course, less margin, but this is where it becomes even that more important for us to think about the balancing act and co-optimizing our TX and RX. In these examples shown here, I went with a shorter length, and I went with presets this time in red and blue that only turn on the TX precursor. And yet we still see that Optimi is giving us about a 2x better result, as shown there. So in conclusion, this is the end of my section of the presentation. I had the overall results. If I roll all this into my spreadsheet and show you what kinds of improvements I got, not against the red or the half-away settings, but always against the PCI Express presets, these are the kinds of improvements I see on the different types of channels. So You know, I think it's fair to point out that my baseline settings were slanted a little more towards loss, but part of why I did that is because that's what we typically see in today's systems, both in the kinds of equalization available and the way people are setting them up right now. So, but even if we dabble around with other settings, we still expect to see Optimi give us about 100% improvement for ISI-dominated channels and about 50% for loss-constrained channels, as you see here. So with that, I'm going to turn the session back over to Todd, who's going to tell you how you do all this. Thank you, Todd.
Thank you very much, Donald. So let's take a closer look at how we would actually run this in practice. And so Optimi is a capability that's been integrated with SciSoft's Quantum Channel Designer. Probably no surprise there. And what happens is that when you're drawing a schematic that has an Optimi-enabled model, what will happen is that there's a parameter in the menu called QCD optimization that you can then drop down to turn optimization on for that transmitter-receiver pair. And there are two modes there. And roughly speaking, probably the way you want to think about it is there's a mode called TX where Optimi is going to optimize the settings for the transmitter with full knowledge of what the receiver is capable of. So it understands what the receiver can do, but it's basically going to control the settings for the transmitter. And then there's a mode called TXRX where basically it's going to take more aggressive control of some of the settings in the receiver. So instead of sort of letting the receiver do its own thing, it's going to sort of manually manage some of those settings. And there are different reasons for that. Generally speaking, the mode that you pick is based on the models that you have. When you run an optimized simulation, what may happen under the hood is it may run things a couple of times, because as we're going to see, we're going to talk about prediction and verification. And so typically what you see is the runtime goes up a bit. But I think the most important thing in my use of this is understanding that most of the time when I've been co-optimizing transmitter receiver settings in the past, I've been using blind sweeps where I go run hundreds of simulations for each pair, you know, because we have a particularly good server farm here at SciSoft. Typically I'll run 300 to 500 per net looking for good settings depending on what I'm trying to do. And with Optimi, instead of running 500, I'm running one that takes three times as long. So I'm going from 500 to 3. And that's a huge gain, not only in terms of elapsed time, but computer resources, licenses, all these other things that I would normally use. Now my answer just pops out instead of me having to do all of the simulation and mining for it. So the way that it works is that Optimi uses a control file that characterizes a particular SerDes transmitter receiver. It basically allows the optimizer to understand what that particular device is capable of. And it talks about things like how many taps does it have and what are their limits and granularity and other things like that, so that when you run a simulation, because you're always going to set something up initially, Optimi can look at the simulation that's been run, predict what it believes the actual optimized result would be. And if the two differ, then it will actually rerun the simulation by changing settings and then see that it's converged on a solution it believes is optimal. So there's that loop there, which is automatic, where if the Optimi doesn't believe that the model is behaving as predicted or doesn't believe the solution is optimal, it will change things and rerun. And then once the result converges, it will output the results. Now, if it happens that you don't have a particular vendor's model characterized, then what you can do is you can use the models that are built into the simulator, which are in and of themselves configurable. So I can take the transmitter model and change the number of taps and the limits, and I can change the receiver model with DFE taps and things like that. And I can use those models to first order approximate the technology that I want to optimize and find settings for it, even when I don't have the control files for a particular vendor's model. Once I get to the point where I have optimized results, there are two things that I care about. Number one is, how good is it? How big is my eye? How wide is my eye? And equally importantly, what settings got me there? Because that's ultimately what I want to go program into my hardware. So what happens is that when we run an optimized simulation, the simulator will report the initial settings that we put into the model, the optimized settings that it derived, and what the resulting margins were. And that happens both in the interactive waveform viewer and in the spreadsheet reports that come out at the backside, so that if you wanted to take that spreadsheet data and post-process it and use it to go drive a system in the lab, you can go do that. You have all that data. It's just there. You can post-process it and do whatever you want with it. So now the use model that we see at the system level is one where we can use Optimi either pre-route or post-route. Pre-route, I'm trying to figure out how far can I push my channels? How long can I make them? How cheap can my dielectric be? How tightly can I pack in those edges before crosstalk takes me out? And what I'm doing in a pre-route space is asking the what-if question, how far can I push it? And that's always contingent on, am I using the best possible settings for any proposed topology? Optimi takes that off the table and figures out those settings. So now I can focus on how long, how far, how fast can I run a particular net. Once I've actually routed that design, now the challenge is, okay, given the particular constellation of nets and lengths that we actually got in layout, you know the drill. The lengths change, the resonances change, the ringing changes, and suddenly things that were supposed to be easy aren't. And I don't want to find that out in the lab. I want to find that out before I fab out. So what Optimi allows me to do is now take that full system, extract the topology for each one of those nets, optimize the transmitter-receiver settings, and figure out if I have an equalization solution for each net in my design before I fab out. And that's the gate that, you know, we all look for. If I've got something in the lab already and it's failing, now I have the ability to say, let's go take the files for that design or measure the failing channels if need be, bring them in, run the optimizer, figure out the optimal settings for the transmitter receiver, take that back into the lab, and see if I can take something that was either marginal or failing and make it perform better without having to do the blind search of settings that I, you know, might have to do in the lab that is particularly painful and expensive. So, again, that's the best of all possible worlds. When I can change nothing but my firmware and take something that was in the way of my system, bring up and now make it work, that's a big win. So at that point, I would. There's one more question that we have for you guys today, and that is, can you give us a sense of how long it's taking you to resolve SERDE settings during system bring-up? Because, you know, we've heard a variety of stories here. Some of our customers are spending weeks or months in the lab trying to resolve these things to get those last few settings. So if you give me a sense of where you guys, what your distribution is, we're interested to see. And then we'll wrap up and open for questions. Okay, and I'll give it about 15 more seconds. And last call. Get your votes in. Okay, and let's take a look. Ready? Here we go. By the way, thank you to everybody who voted. It's too painful to think about. That was my comic relief answer, so I appreciate your willingness to go for that. I know that's hard. But, you know, we see about half of you saying days or weeks. About a quarter of you are saying months. And, you know, there are a few of you that are saying either somebody else is giving it to you or it's too painful to think about. So to wrap up, just to summarize some of the points that we were making here today, first and foremost, I want to make the point that whenever we look at a receiver eye, we often think that the only thing we need to think about is the maximum opening. And we want to remind you that it's not only the maximum opening, it's where the clock is actually going to sample that eye. And yes, we understand that there are receivers that can scan and there are programmable clocks and there are all kinds of things, but at the end of the day, your recovered clock is sampling that eye somewhere, and knowing where it's sampling and doing your reporting based on that is important. One of the things that we're finding now that we've brought this technology online here at SciSoft is that the blind sweeps that we used to do, as much fun as we had running, and I personally had lots of fun running 10,000 simulations and 20,000 simulations, those things were costing us in ways that we didn't always anticipate. It wasn't just time. It wasn't just computers. It wasn't just, you know, licenses or anything. It was the time that we were spending to generate and reviewing the data that was taking up more than we realized. And so by being able to shift more of that burden to the computer, we're seeing benefits that we didn't anticipate. As Donald said, this is the third generation of co-optimization technology from SciSoft. We've actually been doing this for a while now. And most importantly, we think the important thing is that this is not requiring the AMI vendor to change their model. They don't need to change their code. They don't need to recompile things. The control file allows the simulator to understand what that model does and how to optimize it and how to control it. And that means that now we're able to do per-channel optimization automatically at the full system level. And by the way, that's not just a pipe dream. That's the truth. That's what we actually did for some of our customers. That's some of the stuff that we've reported in some of our conference papers is that we've been able to generate custom solutions for every link at the full system level. That's how well this technology can work. So, of course, I'm not asking you to take my word for it. We'd love to actually have you bring your design and try this for yourself. So in a minute here, we're going to pop up our survey form. There's a link that you can follow off to request more information, including the opportunity to see how this works for you. If that form doesn't pop up or you lose the link or whatever, don't worry. You can always go to sysoft.com/optimi, find out more information about this technology, and request an evaluation so that you can see for yourself. So that about does it for me. And Chris, I'm going to turn it back to you.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Great presentation. Before we begin with today's Q&A, please note the survey on your screen. If you do not see the survey, please launch it now by clicking on the survey button on your interface. Thank you in advance for filling it out. Your responses are very important to us and will provide both SciSoft and UBM with valuable feedback on how to improve future webinars. We're now going to move on to the question and answer section of the presentation. As a reminder, if you have a question for our presenters, please submit it now by typing into the text area on the right-hand side of your screen, then click the Submit button. Please note that we will try to get to every question that you ask today, but if we do not get to your question, then someone will get back to you via email after the webinar is over. So we will now move on now with our first question. Looks like our first question is going to be a toss-up for either Todd or Donald. And it says, how can Optimi be combined with built-in self-adaption routines? Will they interfere with one or another?
And so, Chris, I'll take that. So the answer is that what Optimi does is it predicts what the ideal setting for a particular model will be, and then it runs a simulation to see what happens. So, in fact, what happens is there's a prediction, and there's a verification using the vendor's model. And so my answer would be no, they actually don't interfere with one another because we run one then the other and we see what the combined behavior is. And if it doesn't give us the result that we're looking for, then the tool iterates until it finds an acceptable solution.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Our next one is, why does Optimi need an optimization control file?
And so I'll take that one as well. So what happens is that what we're trying to do is we're trying to predict the optimal settings for a transmitter and possibly a receiver. And obviously you need to know what the devices have. Where do they have equalization? What kinds of equalization do they have? So there are two choices here, you know, quite frankly. One is you can go rewrite your AMI model code so that it works with some, I don't know, application programming interface or convention so that the models have some awareness that they didn't have before. People have talked about, you know, AMI models, for instance, that do emulate back-channel adaptation and communicate, which requires actually rewriting that code. The other way to do it is to have an optimizer outside of the model that actually understands what the model is capable of. So it knows what taps does it have, what are their limits, what's the granularity, and it can predict what it believes the optimal settings will be. However, a prediction is not the same as verification or reality. So you need a two-step process. Number one, you predict what you believe the optimal settings will be. Then the other thing you need to do is you actually need to go run the model with those settings and see that you get a result that's acceptable. So that's what that control file is doing, is it's providing both pieces of that equation without actually changing the model itself. It's telling the simulator what is the model capable of, and it's also telling the simulator if you want to run the model with a particular set of settings, how do you turn that into the language that model understands so that the simulator can go do it and verify that result? And that's exactly what that control file is doing.
All right. Thank you, sir. Our next one for you. Do some industry specifications require a particular order to equalization, for example, TX, then RX?
And I'm going to take a crack at that, but I'm also going to turn it over to Donald because the primary answer for me is I don't really know. I think that it's probably obvious that some specifications do talk about transmitting, particularly if you're talking about adaptation or back channel. There's a particular scheme involved. Our goal here is really to figure out what the right combination of settings is independent of path or method, because we're just trying to find the best answer no matter how we get there. And Donald, I'll look to see if you have anything to add to that.
Yeah, thanks, Todd. I would just add that the specifications do a great job of searching the solution space, although they tend to be one-sided, like you're the transmitter or you're the receiver and here's what you should do. So the good thing here is we can look at the whole problem all at once. And I would also add that specifications just don't get it quite as much into that balancing space. And, you know, to reduce risk, from what I've seen in my practice, they do both specifications and component defaults tend to over-equalize and leave some margin on the table.
All right. Thank you, Todd and Donald. Next one for you. Will co-optimization work with full waveform AMI, GetWave, IBIS, hyphen AMI models?
What a great question, and thank you for that question, by the way. So if you looked at the presentation, because I was talking about equalized pulse responses, you would be likely to draw the conclusion that this is only going to work with AMI models that actually can process an impulse response and produce an equalized pulse response. Or put another way, you might think that this is only going to work with models that support statistical analysis. That's not true. This actually works with GetWave models. Obviously, you can't produce the equalized pulse response by the same method, but you can still get there. So, yes, this actually does work with any combination of IBIS AMI models. It's just that if you have a GetWave-only model, we have to run more analysis to get there and derive the response that we need, but it works just as well.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Next one for you. Does the control file describe the TX interface, or is it included, or does it include the TX and the RX?
So another good question. Thank you for that. So the control files are actually per model. So there's a control file for the transmitter, and there's a control file for the receiver. And in fact, what would happen is if you had a control file for your transmitter only, the optimizer would be able to do something based on that, even though it wouldn't really necessarily know what the receiver is doing. But there's a control file per model, and in the best case, you have one for the transmitter and one for the receiver.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Our next one for you, is there a co-optimization result difference between statistical-only nonlinear bit-by-bit and bit-by-bit using statistical convolution models and methods?
There's a mouthful, right? So again, thank you for that question. So I'll point out here that, to be fair, statistical only and bit-by-bit using statistical convolution are really kind of the same thing, right? You're talking about having a model that's only providing a linear response, and whether you predict directly or use bit-by-bit convolution to predict a waveform, you're really talking about the same thing. And so the better question is there a difference between those methods? And the answer is, yeah, of course there is, right? You're talking about different methods. You're going to get a different kind of a response. Having said that, if you have models that are producing comparable results using different methods, you should expect the equalization or the optimization results to be about the same.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Our next one for you. How accurate is the AMI model in the study? Most vendors struggle a lot themselves correlating the TX RX tuning results to their simulations. Without the good TX RX model, how do we decide the FFE, DFE, CTLE coefficient for the actual systems?
Another good question. So in the study that we're presenting today, we're actually using the mathematical built-in models that the simulator has. And the reason why we're doing that is because we can't go public with any particular vendor's model, right? I can't go take any semiconductor vendor and then go publish to the world how their model works. That would violate NDAs. So we're using the models that are built into the simulator that I talked about that are configurable here. And they're actually quite robust. We've had those models for about 6 years now. We've used them in a lot of cases. We've used them to model technologies. We've used them to approximate vendors' models as well, and those models work quite well. The fact is that they are not an actual silicon model because I can't show that in a public webinar. So to that end, what we've done is that we've used this technology as we had said, by creating the control files for different vendors' models, where those models themselves have been correlated back to silicon, running the optimization, bringing those results into the lab, and demonstrating that the optimized system-level results give us the performance that we expected. So a long way of saying the study actually used a spec model because that's all we can show in a public format, but we have done this optimization with accurate vendor models and demonstrated that we get good results in the lab.
Yeah, and if, this is Donald. If I could jump in on that as well, I could also point you to the industry paper again where those were vendor models that had been heavily correlated and then the settings were, you know, run in real systems and that type of thing. So, and I, you know, I have had experience with the control file, and if that strikes fear into any hearts, it's really not that big a deal. We, of course, had to create those for the case described in the industry paper. So that talks in great detail about correlation and such things.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. The next one here for you, looks like we have time for just one more question. Does this co-optimization method require circuit CDR using a Hula Hoop algorithm too?
Another good question. So the Hula Hoop algorithm is a way that you can predict from a pulse response where the CDR will sample that signal. That's not what CDRs actually do, right? CDRs find transitions through zero. They find sort of the left edge of the unit interval. And then from there, they predict where the eye opening will be. So what's really happening here is that the Hula Hoop algorithm is a way of predicting where the CDR will sample the signal based on nothing more than a pulse response. Whereas if I'm doing a bit-by-bit analysis using a real CDR model, what that CDR is going to do is find the left edge of the eye where that thing crosses through zero most frequently. They're both going to give you the same estimation of where the sampling time is because there are two different ways at answering the question, where does the unit interval in the sampled silicon actually begin? So two different ways of getting to the same answer.
All right. Thank you, Todd. Thank you, Donald, for a great Q&A session. That's all the time that we do have for questions for today. I'd like to thank everyone for attending today's webinar, Acerti's Balancing Act, Co-Optimizing TX and RX Equalization Settings to Maximize Margin, brought to you by SciSoft and broadcast by UBM. This presentation will be available shortly in an on-demand format, and as a registered user, you'll receive an email with detailed information on how you can access the on-demand replay of this webinar. The on-demand will also include a PDF copy of the slides used in today's discussion. And just as a reminder to our audience, again, if we did not get to your question today, someone will get back to you via email. This webinar is copyright 2015 by UBM. The presentation materials are owned by or copyrighted by SciSoft, which are solely responsible for their content. The individual speakers are solely responsible for their content and opinions. We'll hope you will join us for future webinars, and on behalf of our guests, Todd Westerhoff and Donald Tellian, my name is Chris Keach. We'd like to thank you for joining us, and we hope you have a great day.